The global policies question is interesting. So I'll answer that first because I think it's a little bit more complicated than the executive orders from the US. But we've seen a few different things manifest in the last, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks, which I find interesting on a global scale.
Justin Hewn, Uranium Insider. Good afternoon to you, my friend. How is it going?
Good afternoon, Andy. It's going really well. Yeah, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again. So what a ride in uranium. We had really, it was weak towards the, last half of the year and going into the first part of this year. Then we've had a really good bounce and a lot of strength. A lot of these undervalued names have really ran up as well as the price itself. So give me your 2 cents on what's going on in uranium and why all of this happened.
Sure. Well, I think coming off of the extreme low sentiment, extreme low RSI, capitulation level trading that we saw in the uranium space late March, bottoming out into early April, and really it was not a very constructive move for the sector leading up to that. So it'd kind of been a little bit of a bounce in January, and then the DeepSeek scare hit. Followed by, the tariff scare and all of these other elements that had led to just kind of weak markets in general, and the uranium equities just went with it. There wasn't really any individual drivers, whether that was the spot price continued to sort of trickle down, bottomed in March at about $63 a pound. So the spot price was kind of going down. There wasn't a lot of positive, like near-term catalysts, let's say, for the uranium market, and we just got coupled in with the broad market. So the equities traded extremely low. Many of them traded below the lows of last summer, which we had the Japanese yen carry unwind and then kind of a retest of those lows in September of last year, followed by a very nice move in Q3 after the WNA, after the news about Constellation's deal with Microsoft for Three Mile Island, et cetera. So the sector was quiet. People were throwing in the towel. In the physical market, we had some financials de-risking and selling a little bit of physical uranium. We had these pounds from ANU, this failed fund, a physical fund in Kazakhstan, just kind of hanging over the market. And we believe that those pounds have been sold and probably forward sold, still on the books for Kazatomprom, but aren't hanging over the market any longer. So the way that was done was a really sloppy manner. That affected things. And then you just had utilities kind of stepping out of the market largely. Just letting the trend play out. The trend was down for the price, especially in the spot price, and they wanted to see how low that would go. So they largely stepped out. As soon as that got into kind of the mid and even into the low 60s, you had utilities step back in. And year to date, we've seen a lot of volume traded in the spot market on behalf of utilities. They've been the majority of the volume traded in the spot market. Usually they're less than 20% of the total volume. This year, it's over 70% is utility involvement. Some of that has had to do as well with carry trade. So we had, a stable $80 a pound in the long term, and you have 3-year forward, 5-year forward, it's higher than that. Utilities want to cover for that time period in shorter and smaller volumes, let's say. They engage in carry trades with a couple of traders, a couple of financials that will go out and buy in the spot market and commit to deliveries in the midterm. So the move for the spot price from low 60s into low 70s has been decent. It's been about an $8 or $9 move off of the bottom. It's, nothing really to write home about, but it's positive. The equities kind of outperformed that move by a factor of 2. And a lot of that was kind of just a dead cat bounce coming off of RSI 20. And these equities were extremely oversold. And as soon as some of the tariff scare went away and as soon as the spot price started to move higher, we saw a decent little risk on move. And that, of course, then got exacerbated by some positive headlines, which were the executive orders that were issued by the Trump administration about 10 days ago, almost 2 weeks ago at this point, that are extremely supportive of new nuclear being built in the United States. We can get into that if you'd like. And, the sentiment swings are extreme in this sector. It's never been another way. It will always be that way. The moves in the equities can be violent. Some of these stocks have more than doubled in the last 8 weeks. Of course, that comes off of pretty bad action for multiple months leading up to that move. But if you can trade in and out of this sector, it really gives you incredible opportunities. And now we've got the wrapping up the World Nuclear Fuel Markets Conference in Sydney, utilities coming back to the table to end the week into the next week. We'll see if that triggers any kind of motion in the physical market in the near term. If not, well, it looks like we've got summertime, a couple of months leading into what we expect to be a very, very strong end to the year following the WNA conference in September. A lot of buying is still on the table for utilities in the midterm. That's what we expect to kind of be the next catalyst after a long period of consolidation for the long-term uranium price.
You talk about consolidation. I know you mean consolidation in the uranium price, but talk a little bit about consolidation with projects and potentially company buyouts, if you see that happening on the horizon, and then work in what you see these new government policies in not only in the U.S., but the rest of the world going really nuclear. Talk a little bit about that and what that means. Obviously, it's bullish over time, but what does that mean to you really over the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, it's hard to say how much sector consolidation we're going to see over that time period. We will see more as the sector progresses, and especially once we see a much more sustained and robust move higher in the uranium price. Since the uranium price has essentially been stagnating here for quite some time, the long-term price goes through these cycles within cycles where you see, you know, a 10 or 15 year period where the long-term price will essentially go up and to the right. But within that, you'll have these moves where it'll go 8 to 12 months of $2 or $3 up moves per month in the long-term price. And then you'll go through a similar period of time where it just kind of, that move is digested by the industry. And that's what we've been experiencing for the past year. The long-term price is within a $2 trading range for more than 12 months right now. So the next move is coming for the long-term price. And all it's going to take is some reasonable amount of demand coming into that market. Year to date, 26 million pounds have been secured in the long-term market. If we annualize that, it's about 30% of replacement rate. So still very, very low volumes being traded in the long-term market. As far as company consolidation, I honestly believe personally there are some very ripe takeout opportunities on the table. The big obvious one is NexGen's Aero, and everybody has been pounding the table for the last 8 or 9 years for Cameco to take them out. Cameco continues to say that they're not interested. They have plenty of tier one and tier two projects that they can fall back on, which they do. But, you know, the premium Cameco to NexGen is pretty extreme right now. It's pretty close to where it was even during COVID, which everyone was really pounding the table. What happens there? I don't know. If anything, who really knows? I don't. Everybody's speculating and pushing for that. That's the big obvious one. I think there's plenty of others that look interesting, some collaboration, some consolidation, possibly some joint venture opportunities. We'll see more of that. That's probably going to heat up once we get into the next sustained move up in price.
Got it. And what should investors look for when they're analyzing a company to potentially invest in, whether that's a producer or whether that's a junior? Do you look for high takeover candidates? Do you look at the project? Do you look at the jurisdiction? What are some of the things that you look for?
I would say right now, I mean, it really depends on where the market is to answer that question in real time. So what has really worked for a lot of, let's say, the last few years is the institutional interest that comes into the market, they go after what's liquid. And so we've seen the large cap liquid names and the nuclear names get a lot more attention, not only just because the nuclear story potentially has, let's say, more of a near to midterm supportive framework. When we see these executive orders, we see the money being offered up in the loan programs and from potentially from the budget that we're still waiting to be passed by the Senate. These things have real near term, drivers for these nuclear stocks. But the nuclear stocks are also far more liquid, to speak generally, than the uranium space. So liquidity is what attracts the institutional investors. And if they're wanting exposure to either the uranium or the nuclear or both, they're going to go for what's liquid first and foremost. And that has generally worked. What I find most attractive right now are two things. Within the uranium space, there are a few explorers. There are a couple of developers that are extremely undervalued to peers. And these stocks in the uranium space specifically are obviously and justifiably so trading according to the price. And the price that everybody sees is the spot price because it's updated on a daily basis. So uranium mining stocks really should be valued based on what is the uranium price and or what is the expected uranium price? And what I see right now in the uranium space is not very many of these equities in that are pure play uranium miners are trading based on an assumption that we're going to see $100 plus uranium. They're trading at $72. And so the disconnect here between the nuclear renaissance story and the de-risking of the growth of demand of nuclear and therefore the growth of demand for the fuel is huge between that and the focus on the actual fuel source itself, which is uranium. So over the last year, year and a half, all of the love has been going into the nuclear story with few exceptions. Yes, the uranium stocks have had a good 6 to 8 weeks. They're up 50 to 100%. That's amazing. The uranium price has recovered a little bit. That's great. But what do these stocks look like at $85, $95, $100 plus uranium? And if you look out into the future, what we expect going out 2 or 3 years is significantly higher price uranium than that. So betting on uranium stocks here, even though some of these are overbought near term, whatever, looking out at an expectation of 100 to 150, and who knows where it could go really, because we see a significant supply problem going out towards the late decade. Where that price can go, we don't really know, but we're going to have to see a re-rating of these stocks when the price moves. So betting on uranium here is betting on a future price move that hasn't manifested yet. Yes, we did see a spike up to 104 in spot and it pulled all the way back down to 63 from the move that started about 45. So 45 to 104 back to 63. We're going to see this again. And that next move in price is coming. It isn't here yet. So in some ways, it is a contrarian bet. It's saying, okay, nuclear is growing. Look at all the drivers of that incredible growth story. What are these things going to be running on? Oh, that's this stuff over here. Maybe that's a secondary bet we can make on that nuclear story. It absolutely is. I love the setup. I love it when I can model out supply and demand and I can know where the price is going, which is up. Where it goes, I don't know. But I know that it's going in this direction and not that one. And so placing a bet on that assurance is one of my favorite types of setups.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely agree. Talk about a little bit about the new policies that came out in the U.S. and also just the global policies, if there are any, that will impact the price and the supply and demand equation.
That's, you know, the global policies question is interesting. So I'll answer that first because I think it's a little bit more complicated than the executive orders from the US. But we've seen a few different things manifest in the last, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks, which I find interesting on a global scale. One is that Germany has essentially finally capitulated to France and allowed nuclear, as far as Germany goes, to be included as a green energy source. And this doesn't seem like much, but what it really means is finally, the primary, with an exception of Austria, the primary anti-nuclear country within the EU bloc has officially flipped and said, okay, nuclear is green and we are going to call it green. So basically that means that these last holdout countries are finally shifting. That opens up the possibility for them to restart reactors, which is possible. Of course, if they do, that will equal new demand that nobody is modeling for. We've also seen Spain go through a kind of a historic countrywide blackout that what it seems like triggered that was too much intermittency and an insufficient, insufficient firmness of the energy source in Spain. And now we're seeing a couple of the utilities that are nuclear operators in Spain push for their reactors to be life extended. So Spain's fleet is 8 reactors. They are all set to close by 2035, and the first ones in the next couple of years. So they might even flip. Lastly, I'll say that Kazakhstan is looking at building nuclear power. They're getting bids from primarily the Russians and the Chinese. And that's really interesting to see because the Chinese are coming in and say, we're going to build you 2 reactors. It's going to cost less than $6 billion for both, and we'll get it done in 5 years. And it's hard to say no to that type of offer. It's incredible. And the Chinese can probably do it. But part of this is that they're saying that the country of Kazakhstan is saying that they intend to build a strategic uranium reserve for the purpose of securing fuel for their own nuclear reactors. And I think this is really interesting because China has already been doing this. They have the biggest inventory Of course, China is going to consume almost 1 billion pounds of uranium in the next 15 years, but they have established a uranium reserve. Will Kazakhstan do it? Will the U.S. do it? Will France do it? And all of these countries that are relying from a national security perspective on nuclear power should, and many of them likely will, establish reserves. That is secondary demand that nobody is modeling for, but it's going to be something. Lastly, I'll answer the executive order question briefly, just to summarize it all. Four different executive orders were signed to reinvigorate the supply chain for nuclear, to reform the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And there's two others that are along that thematic, essentially involving the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, reiterating that the Department of Energy's loan program is going to remain in place. The funding for that, we're not sure yet until we see the finalization of the Senate bill. But the loan program remaining is very good. Some carve-outs from the Inflation Reduction Act were included in the House bill that passed. We're still waiting to see the size and the amount of tax credits and whether or not the investment tax credits will remain with the Senate bill. Big fingers crossed on that. A lot of entities are pushing very hard for those tax credits to remain. I would say the most notably bullish, for lack of a better word, but really the most visible piece of these executive orders for the nuclear and uranium front is essentially that in one of the executive orders, they are requiring that by 2030, we will see 10 large reactors at least begin construction with finalized designs. So important that that's part of the language, because Vogtle 3 and 4 began construction without the design actually being finalized. That led to a lot of problems and a lot of cost and schedule overruns for Vogtle, especially Vogtle 3. Once Vogtle 3 was built, Vogtle 4 went much, much faster, much cheaper than 3. So they're saying you got to have the designs finalized and you got to have shovels in the ground by 2030 for 10 new large reactors. And that's a big signal, because the U.S. hasn't built anything besides Vogtle 3 and 4 since 1978, when the NRC was established. And so this reaffirmation of the NRC, it's a little bit controversial. And they're basically saying you have to look at radiation not as an absolute zero in terms of risk, but you have to balance that with the risk of not building any more nuclear, which we need. So clearly the administration is very, very behind this with these executive orders. Now we wait for the Senate bill to be finalized to see exactly what's in it and in supportive of nuclear, but moving in the right direction, absolutely, for new builds in the U.S. And that's a big signal to the globe.
Yeah, it really is. And it's really teeing it up for investors here. And I say this as a uranium investor, is they're already telling you what they're going to do or what they want to do. And now it's, as an investors, it's our job to do our homework, make our list of our favorite plays, if you would, and take advantage of, as an investor, take advantage of really the market disconnect between price of the equities as well as price of where we see uranium projecting to.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's the uranium, the disconnect between the fuel cycle and especially in uranium as the primary first step in source fuel to fuel this global nuclear renaissance is huge right now. It really is. So that's really what has me most excited. Of course, the big news over the last few days also was that Meta has signed an agreement with Constellation for the life extension of the Clinton plant, which was set, the clean energy credits that plant was receiving are set to expire in 2027, along with the expected shutdown of that reactor. So as part of this deal with Meta, Constellation is applying to the NRC for a 20-year life extension. They're going to get it. And Meta will then has a power purchase agreement to buy electricity from this plant for a 20-year period. AI, data centers, tech demand, this is all absolutely still part of the process, part of this overall story. This doesn't appear to be slowing down. In addition to securing near-term energy for these data centers via gas and tapping into the existing grid, these tech companies are still 100% on board with securing nuclear power and potentially aiding in building nuclear power in the United States and elsewhere to power these with clean, firm energy for a century. That's the long term. Gas might get them over the line in the near term, but that's going to face major fluctuations in price over the coming decades. Whereas they can secure nuclear power these for a stable expected cost, because the uranium and the inputs of the fuel cycle are a minority percentage of the percent of the overall operating cost of those plants. So it's much more predictable in terms of cost for that electricity. With all of that said, I think as soon as, especially we hear finalization on the Senate bill, we're going to hear announcements of new builds in the United States. And I would not be surprised at all to see the tech companies involved with the utilities, with the nuclear builders, and potentially with these nuclear companies that are contracting and developing and connecting all of these parties together. And there's so much more is happening on that front. And this is what's so exciting for the long runway for the sector is this is all in its infancy. You know, the where the price is going in the next 2 or 3 years, that is based on what is operating, what is under construction and is going to hit the grid, and how much supply or not is going to meet that demand. And that's something we can model. The new builds and the potential new builds in places like the United States are in nobody's models. So these really get exciting for a much more longer term runway for the sector.
Yeah, and that really, if you can comment just really briefly about if you have these new builds or if you have new exploration companies or you have companies that are coming into production, how long is that process from discovery to being permitted to being produced? Meaning it sounds to me that, and I know the answer sort of, but I want you to answer it. That's a long time.
In terms of uranium supply, new projects, uranium,
from discovery to bringing it to into the supply chain, that's years of work.
Yes. Usually from discovery to production, it's more than a decade and sometimes significantly so. When we're talking about new projects in established jurisdictions, especially if they are ISR, so for Kazatomprom or their joint ventures to go into a deposit that maybe that was explored 5 years ago, they can get that going much faster because it's a much more, I shouldn't say simpler, but less capital and time intensive development for ISR versus open pit or underground. So that's kind of an exception to that rule. When we talk about large underground projects like NextGen's Arrow, for example, you know, this was discovered back in the early 2010s. They were expecting first production from Arrow in 2027, just 2 years ago. Now first production, likely first cake in a can, is looking like 2031. And just last year, December last year, 6 months ago, they signed contracts with First Uranium delivery in 2029. And this is in no way any sort of dishing on the company, because the company is doing, as far as I can tell, the best they can to get this project going and dealing with the regulatory bodies and waiting for permitting. But their last hearing is in February of next year. Best case scenario, they get permits kind of middle of the year. Then they've just updated their time frame for development to 48 months. So that's mid 2030 if absolutely everything goes perfect to plan.
And, which always happens in mining, right?
Yeah, every time. So delays in projects like Arrow, and there's many others, obviously, the Greenfield projects, they just take time and they take a lot of money and they take de-risking from the industry. So Arrow is a very low cost project. This is going to get built by them or by somebody at some point, just because it's 250 million pounds of high grade uranium with, 80 million pounds inferred. And now they're drilling out Patterson Corridor East and hitting great intercepts. So this could be a monstrous, 300-500 million pound, deposit between these two deposits. And if they build that mill, it's just huge, but a shovel hasn't hit the ground yet. And so when you look at the models from somebody like UxC, who doesn't actually model in supply for a project that hasn't started to be built yet, the deficit between supply and demand is massive. So where we're at right now in terms of supply, just to put it really briefly, is that we're nearing the end of brownfield restart potential. So we've seen Langer-Heinrich get restarted in Namibia. We've seen multiple small US ISR projects get restarted. We've seen the Honeymoon project in Australia be restarted by Boss. And there's a couple of others, but these restarts, the MacArthur River obviously restarted. The restarts of brownfield, there isn't a whole lot more supply that can come from brownfield restarts. And a lot of that's in the United States, which is higher cost. So will we see another 5 or 6 million pounds come out of the US? We probably will. It's gonna take a few years to get there. The next element of supply that will have to come into existence is all coming from from Greenfield. These are new projects that are under development or have yet to be developed. That's Global Atomics Dasa in Niger, Denison's Phoenix, NextGen's Arrow. There's a few in the United States. And then there's the big open pit projects in Namibia from Deep Yellow, from Bannerman, potentially from Forsys, from a couple of others. And those projects continue to get delayed based on the existing pricing environment and the lack of utilities' willingness, as of now, to step in and pay significantly higher prices and move that price higher. So we've heard both Bannerman and Deep Yellow saying, we're delaying our final investment decision. We're not going to do that FID until we have a better pricing environment and much more signal from the utilities that we can de-risk the development of this project. We're looking at hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in multiple years to build these large open pit mines and the processing facilities for that. Or you're just not going to do that on the chance that when the mine is built, you'll have a good environment to sell into. You need stable pricing higher than here for these big projects to be built. And even the low-cost projects that will get built eventually, those are going to be delayed. And it's not, we don't model for a delay. We model for Arrow first cake in the can in 2031. That's what's in our model. Is it likely to be delayed beyond that? Well, there's plenty of people in the industry that believe that that will be the case, especially if we get into some kind of buyout situation. So hard to say, but supply is the problem. And it will be a problem going forward. And the industry sees the feasibility studies that the investors see and the utilities go, oh, well, we can just get uranium from Bannerman in 2028. And it's like, yeah, maybe, but maybe not. So it's going to be very interesting to see the next few years play out and how these projects are delayed or not, and what that does to the price if and when they are.
Justin, tell me a little bit about Uranium Insider, or tell me a lot about Uranium Insider, your process and evaluation in there, and how you helped investors make great investment decisions within uranium.
Sure. So I would say the primary mechanism in which we help investors make wise decisions in the sector is to cover thoroughly the physical uranium market and keep updates on that on practically a daily basis. So that's the primary of any commodity investment, is understanding what the hell is going on with the commodity. You have to know that, all right? The capital markets are one area that's also relevant, of course, and perhaps even more relevant in the near term for the fluctuations in the equities valuations. But in the long term and the overall trajectory of this investment, we want to know what's going on with the commodity. So we've built that. We have thousands of hours into a very thorough supply and demand model, which informs where we believe the price is going to go. And that gives us a lot of confidence. And then the daily communication with our membership, especially during times like March leading into April, was very, very important. We've received so many communications from our membership since then for people thanking us for aiding their conviction to hang on through that and to put money to work when it was extreme blood in the streets. So maintaining communication, keeping tabs on the physical market, and then, of course, taking the enormous complexity of information that's always spinning around this sector and distilling that down into what you need to know as an investor to make wise decisions in the sector. We have a small team. We've been doing this for 6 years now, and we have a long runway. I can't believe I'm saying that in 2025. Looking at this market back in 2019, 2020, 2021, I would have thought we were in inning two or three. I honestly think that we're closer to the beginning than the end still, even though we're 9 years from the bottom of the commodity right now. That happened in 2016. Incredible to say that, but every investor should always take a snapshot of where you are and where you think you are in that investment based on the changing information. When information changes, my mindset changes. And so what has changed since that time frame? Massive de-risking of demand, life extensions almost across the board, a shifting sentiment towards nuclear. The growth rate has gone from 1 or 2% to 4 to 5% compound annual in demand. In the last 5 years, electricity demand is huge and completely de-risked the entire U.S. fleet and any other country that has a large amount of data centers to be built. So that those statistics changed. And when those change, you have to take a different picture of the overall setup here. So what we see is an incredible de-risking of demand based on the growth of nuclear, the life extensions of the existing fleet largely, compared to a supply story that has yet to respond sufficiently to the projected demand. that gives us a lot of confidence going forward. We expect to see large moves in the price, perhaps beginning as soon as this year. And that is going to continue generally up and to the right for many, many years to come. Will we see big spikes and retracements? Absolutely. Will volatility reign supreme? 100%. But the general trajectory is going to continue to be to the upside unless and until we see some surprise amount of supply coming from somewhere, which we don't know where that could be. And importantly, last point, Andy, there just isn't a buffer of secondary supplies and inventory overhanging the market. And that is the big thing that's different right now from any point in the history of this industry. There has always been a massive amount of secondary supply and or inventory out there to buffer price moves. And now we're in this place where the supply that the industry is going to rely on for the next 10 years plus has to literally come out of the ground. And any disruption to that is going to have an impact on price. And that's really the exciting setup here.
Yeah, all investors that are listening, please take note of that. And absolutely, and that should help you with seeing the value really, and as I do, especially with this recent sell-off in the last, I would say, six months to nine months. It's a great spot for investors to take advantage of. Justin Hoon, Uranium Insider. I'm going to link to you in the show notes, both on this show as well as the Apple Podcast and Spotify. I want to thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate your expertise.
It's always my pleasure, Andy. It's great to be on with you again.
Take care.